Live from WNUR News, I'm Ali Bianco. You're listening to the 6 o'clock news on WNUR 89.3 FM /HD1, Evanston, Chicago. It's Friday, April 15th, 2022. Tonight on WNUR News, closing out Chicago Restaurant Week, the downfall of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, and the war between Elon Musk and Twitter. Those stories coming up tonight on WNUR News at 6. Thanks for tuning in. The annual Chicago Restaurant Week came to an end this past Sunday. The week-long event features discounts and special sales at some of Chicago's favorite places to eat. Follow Jennifer Kim as she speaks with Northwestern students who went to grab a bite.
Chicago Restaurant Week.
Chicago Restaurant Week.
Chicago Restaurant Week is finally here.
Starting from Friday, March 25th, up to last Sunday, April 10th, Chicago had a very special annual event called the Chicago Restaurant Week. As many of you may already be familiar with, during this period, Michelin star restaurants offer their food at a lower price, allowing more people to afford it. TJ Kim, a sophomore at Northwestern University, made a visit to one of the restaurants on April 1st.
I mean, like, initially, I wanted to, you know, participate in the Chicago Restaurant Week mainly because I thought I would try out different restaurants in like a couple of days, but then I ended up going to just one, which is funny.
While he was unable to follow his initial plan of trying multiple restaurants, TJ says he did enjoy his experience at the one restaurant he was able to visit.
I visited Boulevard Chicago Steakhouse.
As a big fan of steak, TJ had always hoped to check out many of these steakhouses, and Chicago Restaurant Week appeared to be one of the best opportunities to do so.
Mainly because, like, I always wanted to go there because I love going to different steakhouses. If you call it steakhouse hopping, sure. But Chicago being one of the most prominent steakhouses, I wanted to try different steakhouses.
According to TJ, the meal is usually $30 to $50 per person. Let me do the math for you real quick. If you multiply 30 by 2, that's 60. If you multiply 50 by 2, that's 100. Which means on an average day, a two-person meal would cost 60 minimum and 100 maximum.
But then, me being a student, under a budget constraint, I was not able to do so. So I thought Chicago Restaurant Week was such a good opportunity for me to try the steakhouse that I wanted to go at a fairly cheap price. The price was very fair. I think I paid $55, including if you include tip, like $70.
Quite surprising, huh? $55 is less than the minimum price that people would have to pay regularly. He further adds that the food quality was chef's kiss.
Price was very fair. I think I paid $55, if you include tip, like $70. Which for a dinner course meal, I was served with an appetizer of kale Brussels sprout salad, and for my entree, short rib barbacoa, and for the dessert to finish off, I ate sweet potato cake, which was kind of a nourishing experience. To have a sweet potato cake in the steakhouse was a surreal experience, I guess.
But if TJ had to point out a flaw, he says there was a slight disappointment in the choice of the menu.
But the fact that I wasn't able to eat like a normal steak per se, the price could have been better, I guess.
He went for the steak but didn't get that steak. In general, the food was nice, but the mood was a plus. As always, good mood comes with good food.
The atmosphere itself wasn't that crowded, nor was it too noisy as I expected, considering it being a Chicago Restaurant Week. I can't say quiet, but normal, after all.
When asked whether he would recommend this annual event to other students, TJ gave an unsure response.
I can't firmly say yes or no, because I only went to just one restaurant instead of many, which I had the opportunity to. So I guess 50-50 for sure.
For all the freshmen, Chicago Restaurant Week could be potentially another bullet point to your bucket list. Talk to other people who've been to the event. Perhaps they have a better, or maybe even worse, experience. But I'd say giving it a try won't hurt, especially with the low prices. This is Jung and Jennifer Kim signing off from WNUR News.
Welcome back. It's 6.09 p.m. Central Time. Next up, did you know there's a secret door next to East Fairchild that holds a huge collection of archives? Reporter Margot Amuyal investigates the mysterious door and speaks with students and faculty about the underground archival collection.
Oh, actually, it doesn't. It doesn't look familiar.
I didn't really think much of it. I just walked past.
Now that you see it, like, do you remember ever walking past it?
No.
If you've ever walked past the Fairchildren, and specifically East Fairchild, or if you've ever walked past Kresge, or if you've ever walked out of Fisk and Losey, then you may have noticed this steep downhill going towards this gray door. It's surrounded by these rock-looking bricks, and it's pretty unclear what's located there. So one day, when walking out of class, I saw it and I thought to myself, what is that? So I decided to go find out. From WNUR News, you're listening to News at 6.
Walking into the vestibule of the LSF, and we're going through a chamber that helps to maintain temperature and humidity control. And now we are in the main chamber of the LSF. Allow me to turn the lights on so you can see.
That was the voice of Kevin Leonard, university archivist, who has been working in the Northwestern Archives for over 42 years. Kevin graduated from Northwestern in 1977 and has been working in the university archives ever since. After going through multiple doors, card checks, and security mechanisms, we finally entered where the mysterious door leads to.
And it is a basic structure in that it is not meant to be physically attractive or appealing. You know, we're underground. We have no windows. There are no concessions to beauty.
The LSF inside looks like a long corridor packed with stacks and stacks of bookshelves that slide to accommodate for more space.
So it's a big storage facility for the university.
That was Sarah Picard, the Dean of Libraries and the Charles Deering McCormick University Librarian. Kevin now explains the main items that are featured inside the LSF.
To some degree, books and magazines, newspapers, journals. But most of the material that we have in here will be written records, university records, or personal papers of individuals. So we have millions upon millions, uncounted millions of documents. So we're looking at official records of the institution, reports, publications, et cetera, that help document Northwestern or the people who are associated with Northwestern.
And even if everything here were to be digitized, it is still critical to have the documents themselves.
If you're a research library that saves one-of-a-kind material like archives, you might be the only library that has that thing and you don't dare throw out the original.
And there is a wide variety of cool objects featured in the LSF, such as objects detailing the life of graduate Jackie Mayer, who won the Miss America contest in 1963. Jackie was a talented singer from a young age. However, after suffering from a stroke, her career nearly got derailed. Fortunately, she was able to recover, sing again, and eventually became a motivational speaker for those impacted by disabilities.
Hers is an inspirational tale of someone who overcame adversity.
Here's an example of the work featured about Jackie.
What you and I are looking at now is a round that is painted red, white, and blue. It has a picture of Miss Mayer in the center. It says, "Welcome home, Jackie Mayer," dated 1963. This is an object that hung in multiple copies on lampposts, streetlights, in her hometown of Sandusky, Ohio.
And there's also some sports artifacts, too.
All right, so that's a Northwestern football jersey from 1904, 1905. It's purple. It's bright purple. I've seen photographs of these teams, and the photographs are always black and white. So in my mind, I think about years past, and everything was black and white. And so when this thing arrived at archives and I opened the box, I was bowled over.
Interacting with so many materials from people who have passed away, it made me wonder, has Kevin ever believed in ghosts or even interacted with them?
No, not in the spooky sense, not in the supernatural sense. I don't. Never had a spectral encounter. I've spent so many years, in effect, communicating with the dead and helping the voices of people from earlier periods of time survive into the present and express themselves to our patrons, that I think if there were ghosts, one of them would have tapped me on the shoulder by now. And that hasn't happened, so.
Kevin said every single day on the job, he has found something that has intrigued him. However, there is one moment that stands out. Early in his career, the archives unit went to collect records at Northwestern's downtown campus in a formerly locked room and bring the records back to the library. As they went through the room, Kevin found a paper bag in the back.
Grabbed the paper bag to see what the heck is in there, and I opened it, and the first thing I pulled out was a ransom note from the 1920s.
The ransom note was for Bobby Franks, the son of the wealthy Franks family, who was kidnapped and murdered in Chicago in May of 1924.
That document is from one of the most notorious and known crimes in American history. It's the Leopold and Loeb crime.
Kevin was shocked.
I don't think my knee buckled, but I knew it was something really significant. And I knew immediately, and I was in my 20s at the time, I knew immediately that if I stayed in the archives trade for a long period of time, which I did, my career is kind of over at that point. I will never find anything like that again. And I haven't. You know, that something that noteworthy. We've got wonderful collections, magnificent materials in here, but something that was so well known in its day that I would never see anything like that again. And in a way, I'm glad, because it is reflective of something that was dreadful.
And empowering people to continue to tell their stories and future generations to learn about the land they're standing upon makes Kevin feel he has a pretty fulfilling job.
I believe that the university, through this program of saving historical records, is doing something nice for people. We're in the business of collecting material that will support and sustain research and hopefully increase the knowledge of the people who do that research or the readers of the product of that research. That's our mission, but undoubtedly, I get to make people happy.
So next time you're walking near the Rock, the Medill buildings, the Fair Children, Kresge, or even near Maine, just think you're really close to a whole underground archival treasure trove. Reporting for WNUR News, I'm Margot Emuel.
Now to this week's State of the N Union with Pause Bomb.
Of the N Union, your weekly ASG Senate coverage. On Wednesday, senators discussed the presidential election and a new resolution to uplift MENA students on campus. ASG elections are happening right now. To vote, go to asg.northwestern.edu and under the Presidential Election 2022 menu, click Election Schedule. Under that same menu, you can click the candidates to learn more about who is running and their platforms. You can also listen to coverage of Tuesday's presidential debate on WNUR's website, wnur.news. Make sure you get your vote in by Saturday at 7 p.m. At Wednesday's Senate meeting, Senator Mahdi Hasib introduced a resolution regarding Middle Eastern and North African, or MENA, Northwestern students. Co-sponsored by the MENA Student Association president, two professors in the MENA Studies department, and over 60 students, the resolution calls on the university to, among other things, include a MENA box on all university forms that ask for respondents' race. Now, MENA students have to indicate themselves as white, and allocate a physical space for MENA students on campus to meet and hold events. No senators spoke against the legislation, and the Senate passed it by unanimous consent. Do you find yourself sleeping through your 8 a.m.s? If so, you might be excited by the Wildcats Need Their Sleep resolution introduced by Senator Stephanie Shields. If passed, the resolution would ask Northwestern to offer at least one section of every class to begin after 9:30 a.m., some senators voiced concerns of scheduling issues that may arise for individual departments. That's all for today's State of the N Union. Check in next Friday to see what ASG has been up to between now and then. For WNUR News, I'm Pat Baum.
Moving on to arts and entertainment, a new Hulu miniseries, The Dropout, follows fraudulent medical tech company Theranos and its CEO, Elizabeth Holmes. With trials for Holmes underway and the case fresh on everyone's minds, reporter Pari Pradhan covers the rise and fall of Theranos.
In 2003, a 19-year-old Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of Stanford University with the hopes of transforming the blood testing industry and the world. 15 years later, she's regarded as one of the biggest failures in Silicon Valley. The new Hulu show, The Dropout, shows how this happened. Starring Amanda Seyfried as Holmes, the critically acclaimed show takes us through the rise and fall of Theranos, Holmes' fraudulent healthcare company that vowed to revolutionize blood testing technology. Theranos claimed that it had created a form of blood test that could run hundreds of tests on just one drop of blood, therefore eliminating the need for blood to be drawn by needles and in tubes. Additionally, these tests were to be run in Walgreens stores all across America for a fraction of the cost of regular blood tests. If it were true, this would have allowed for the groundbreaking ability to conduct preventative blood testing at low costs, meaning people could regularly test their blood even without the presence of any symptoms and catch any pathologies before they progress to a point of no return.
We see a world in which every person has access to actionable health information at the time it matters. A world in which no one ever has to say, if only I'd known sooner. A world in which no one ever has to say goodbye too soon.
Theranos' radical promises made its worth skyrocket to a $10 billion valuation in 2013 and 2014. Elizabeth Holmes, as the very young female founder and face of the company, then became the world's youngest self-made female billionaire. In 2014, this made Holmes a feminist icon, a woman that had broken through the tough, male-dominated tech and medical industries with a product that not only had high value, but also promised to bring a lot of good to the general public.
When people talk about glass ceilings, I always say that next to every glass ceiling, there's an Iron Lady.
It's unfortunate, then, that it was all a lie. In 2015, The Wall Street Journal's John Carreyrou published the article that would be the beginning of the end of Theranos. Quote, hot startup Theranos has struggled with its blood test technology, unquote, unraveled the elaborate series of lies that Holmes and her partner in crime, Sonny Balwani, had spun in order to get Theranos backed by an incredibly strong board and $700 million worth of investments. The article quoted whistleblowers from the company who exposed that the revolutionary technology that Theranos was using did not work. The company was deleting any research that showed the grave inaccuracies of their tests and would water down their blood samples to run them through old blood testing machines, leading to several false test results. One of the key whistleblowers in this case, a freshly out of college Erica Chung, spoke out against the company despite their many threats to sue her.
We would be sitting in a lab meeting reviewing data to confirm whether the technology worked or not. And we'd get data sets like this and someone would say to me, well, let's get rid of the outlier and see how that affects the accuracy rate.
Once the news of Theranos' fraud was revealed, the situation quickly spiraled out of Holmes' control. By June of 2016, her net worth dropped from $4.5 billion to virtually nothing. By 2018, Theranos had completely dissolved. But despite it all, despite the false medical tests that affected real people's lives, the hundreds of jobs that were lost when Theranos went under, just months after the office's doors closed for the last time, Elizabeth Holmes was found partying with her new boyfriend at the Burning Man Festival. As seen by the success of The Dropout, the absurdity of it all makes for great television. Today, Holmes is facing prison time. She was found guilty of at least four charges of fraud in January of 2022, though her sentencing date has not yet been determined. The consequences of her actions and the downfall of Theranos not only led to the misdiagnoses of several people who used her tests across the country, but also furthered the misogynistic startup culture, rebuilding barriers that in 2013, everyone thought Holmes had torn down for businesswomen. If you're interested in learning more about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, make sure to watch The Dropout, available on Hulu now. For WNUR News, this was Pari Pradhan, signing off.
And last up for the week, tech giant Elon Musk believes Twitter is in need of an update. Taking things into his own hands, he's now attempting to buy the company. Emily Teotonio has the story.
Elon Musk has the Twitter board of directors in a tight spot with a new bid that values the company at $43 billion.
My strong intuitive sense is that having a public platform that is maximally trusted and broadly inclusive is extremely important to the future of civilization.
But you've described yourself.
I don't care about the economics at all.
Tesla CEO Elon Musk is known for his rampant use of the social media platform known as Twitter. Unlike other CEOs, Musk is praised for his unprofessional use of the platform, making him more likable. Throughout his usage of Twitter, he has voiced many of his grievances, one being that Twitter was in dire need of an edit button, which would enable users to change tweets after being posted. Musk sees Twitter as a center of free speech, and so he's willing to spend time, money, and effort to make Twitter the best platform for its users. He started buying shares of the company on January 31st. By April, Musk acquired a 9% stake in the company, becoming the largest shareholder. Currently, Vanguard Group has surpassed him in Twitter shares. Musk was offered a seat on the board of directors this past week. He believed that if he had a seat, he would personally influence the platform's changes. The current CEO of Twitter, Parag Agrawal, was thrilled, believing that someone as passionate as Musk was needed on the board. Musk has spent this past week suggesting improvements to the platform. One was to give verification checkmarks to those who pay for Twitter Blue, a premium subscription service. The fee should match the local currency, suggesting users to pay with other forms of money, such as cryptocurrency. He also suggested to remove advertisements from the platform entirely, which was 90% of Twitter's revenue in 2021.
Twitter has become kind of the de facto town square, so it's just really important that people have both the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law. One of the things that I believe Twitter should do is open source the algorithm and make any changes to people's tweets, you know, if they're emphasized or de-emphasized, that action should be made apparent so anyone can see that that action has been taken. So there's no sort of behind the scenes manipulation, either algorithmically or manually.
But in the same week, he turned down the seat on the board. Yesterday, Musk launched a takeover bid. The bid states that he would privatize and own the company. He offered $54.20 in cash per share. The board of directors met to discuss a potential buyout. On Friday, they decided to adopt the poison pill, or shareholder rights plan. This plan creates more shares in the market, allowing shareholders to buy them at a discount. This would make it difficult for Musk to increase his stake beyond 15%. In a company meeting, Agrawal said that the company had a strong culture of protecting its users and that no one man can change that. The horrors of war are still upon us as the battle over ownership continues. Who will wave the white flag? Twitter or Musk?
Welcome back to WNUR News. It's 6:28 p.m. Central Time. A look at the weather for tonight. It's scattered showers in the mid-50s for the rest of Friday evening, but it looks like the sky will be clearing up for the weekend. Saturday will have a high of 46, but Sunday will drop to mid and high 30s with partly cloudy skies. Here at WNUR, we're happy Thursday's wind gusts are far behind us. Taking a look into the headlines, Northwestern's positivity rate has climbed to 5.91%, the second highest levels since the beginning of the pandemic. The city of Evanston has seen a similar jump, reporting over 100 more cases in the area compared to last week. We heard about Chicago Restaurant Week, but did you know this week was also Evanston Restaurant Week? All of your Evanston favorites had discounts and specials to boot. If you missed out, it's only 6:29 p.m. If you hurry, maybe you too can participate, after our broadcast, of course. And in sports this week, Northwestern's women's basketball superstar Veronica Burton was picked 7th in the overall WNBA draft. The backcourt burglar will be going pro with the Dallas Wings. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on Twitter at WNUR News. And you can listen to these and other stories of the day on our website, WNUR.news. That's WNUR.news. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Our producer today is Justine Fisher, and our reporters are Jennifer Kim, Margot Amuyal, Pradi Perhan, Paz Baum, and Emily Tinotonio. From all of us here at WNUR News, I'm Ali Bianco. Thanks for listening. Catch our next newscast on Monday, April 18th at 6 p.m. Now back to scheduled programming.